Set your course for the Huff
Takes Podcast.
Welcome to Hoth Takes. I'm Eric Geller.
And I'm Grace Seegers.
And Haley could not be with us, unfortunately, for this episode, but we are going to persevere without her, much like the main character of Andor, the new Disney Plus series, which is the topic of this episode. We're here to talk about the first four episodes of 12 in Andor Season 1. So the first third of the show, we thought this was a good opportunity to do a check-in, look at this chunk of the series, where it takes us, what our initial impressions are of everything that's going on, and how we think this gets things started, what Tony Gilroy has built here with Andor. Before we go into the nitty-gritty, Grace, do you want to just give your high-level impression of Andor at this point?
Yeah, I'm kind of worried that this episode of Hoth Takes is just going to be 45 minutes of us being like, wow, we really like it. It's really cool. Or at the very least, that's kind of my reaction. In our previous episode where we talked about how our different expectations for Andor, I reiterated that I was skeptical, but I really wanted to believe, a la the X-Files poster. And I have to say, four episodes in, I keep waiting for it to disappoint me, and it really hasn't so far. In fact, it has consistently exceeded my expectations. So I really like it. I think it's the best live-action content we've seen from Star Wars since Rogue One. And I'm really excited to see where it goes next. What about you, Eric?
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree with you. I know that's pretty boring, but I was not one of those people who was like, you know, just completely head over heels in love with Rogue One, like obsessed with it. I know that that is one of the movies in the Disney era that has its people who are like, this is my Star Wars. For me, it was fine. It was good. Like, the fact that we knew where things were going for me took a little bit of the luster out of it. But I liked the cast, and I thought that it was produced very well. The story just was not driving it for me. So I was kind of nervous about Andor. But honestly, I think Tony Gilroy and the team have really delivered. I agree with you that this is the best Star Wars live action since that point. And I think I would even say, you know, it going back maybe another year to include The Force Awakens and just say best live action Star Wars of the Disney era. It's firing on all cylinders right now in a way that I had started to think was not possible for Star Wars. But as we're going to get into here, turns out it was possible if you did certain things differently. So, hats off to, you know, we've certainly been critical of certain choices that Disney and Lucasfilm have made, but in this case, hats off to them and the powers that be for basically allowing Tony Gilroy to do what he wanted to do with the show.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with you that it might be the best live action of the Disney era. I won't go that far yet until we have seen the whole show because, hey, there's 8 episodes left, plenty of time for us to be disappointed. But since we're talking about what we like about the show, I think you have to start by talking about sort of the feel, the tone, the genre almost of the show. It was very much marketed as a more mature Star Wars story, grittier, an espionage type thriller that was considered more grounded. Repeatedly, Tony Gilroy and other execs would talk about how, you know, this is about real, ordinary, non-Skywalker, non-Jedi or Sith folks. And I think that you can really see that in the first few episodes, and it's the better for it. In our show notes, we have the section of maturity, and the first note that you make is that the first scene of the whole show takes place in a brothel. And I think that's a really great establishing sort of scene setter, in that this lets you know that this will be a different kind of Star Wars. I also think that first scene where Cassian ends up killing the two pre-war jerks is also very clearly heavily indebted to Blade Runner and to that sort of rain-soaked neon noir feel, while, of course, putting its own flavor and spin on it. And I think both of those really establish for the viewer that what you think you usually get from a Star Wars show slash movie, you're not going to get here. This is going to be different, and it's going to be more grown up. And, you know, there's a time and a place for fun kids Star Wars, but it's really fun to see them expand into seeing what that kind of gritty Star Wars some fans have been waiting for a long time would actually look like.
Yeah, I mean, it just, it shows you what's possible in Star Wars, what you can do if you remove certain constraints. And you know, I have in this section on maturity, there's a couple other things that I think are notable. You know, it's taking Star Wars to places that we had sort of come to believe, maybe not explicitly, but sort of subconsciously, oh, there are certain guardrails on what Star Wars can be. Like, you would never see this in Star Wars. And some of those things, some of those thises are actually being shown now, right? So, I mean, there's a pretty steamy scene in those first three episodes. I forget which one, but it's, I tweeted that it was like the closest that we're probably ever going to get to a sex scene in Star Wars, where it's very clear what's going on here, what's about to happen here. Never seen anything like that in Star Wars before. There's a character who uses the S word, which I, you know, even saying it that way because we're a family podcast, so that's all I'm going to say. But again, not something that you're used to from Star Wars. Marvel has been doing it, so it's something that Disney is comfortable with in certain settings. But it's one of those things where you sort of think to yourself, Star Wars doesn't do that. They make up curse words so that you can tell that the person is cursing without actually having to, you know, subject the audience, which could potentially include a lot of children, to real curse words. And here they're just like, no, we're going to do that. If the scene calls for that kind of emotion and a line that needs to evoke that kind of frustration, we're just going to use it. We're not going to hide behind sci-fi, you know, the swearing equivalent of techno babble, where it's just like that's a sci-fi trope that they make up swear words. Not here, not in Tony Gilroy's Star Wars. So I think that's another example of they're just taking it. They're exploring the darker side of Star Wars. And you see that, too, with the whole story on Ferrix. I mean, the idea of telling a story about an insurgency, about the occupiers coming in and being on uneasy terrain, and that the people who are being oppressed having these ways to fight back, having these ways to sabotage the oppressors. We see all kinds of parallels to the real world when we watch that story play out, and it isn't something that's necessarily been explored with that level of depth, at least in live action. Clone Wars has done it, particularly with some of the insurgency story arcs that they do there. But this is the first time that live-action Star Wars has really dwelled on that. Again, credit to Rogue One for having some of that as well. But this is the center of the story, and so I think that's just great. Grace, you also made a note that it focuses a lot on politics in a way that is unusual for on-screen Star Wars content.
Yes, I think one of my favorite things about some of the Star Wars books, particularly the Thrawn books, are the level of politics in them, and you sort of see the backstabbiness of the Empire and how if you are in the Empire, you always have to be thinking three steps ahead. You always have to be making sure that your rival isn't coming up to stab you in the back. And how can you stab them in the back first? And in the fourth episode, especially, we got a look at that in terms of the Imperial Security Bureau, which was so fun for me to see the kind of security state of Star Wars and how this actually works in terms of how do you keep the populace under control on every single level. So from the level of occupation all the way up to espionage. And one of my favorite scenes in that fourth episode was them talking about in the meeting of all the ISB agents, the filling the detention quotas and just the cool, calculated way that they were talking about lives in terms of numbers. I think that was a really interesting thing that we've never seen in Star Wars. We've never really thought of the apparatus behind the empire, not just the emperor himself and his minions, but the sort of mid-level managers and how they operate. So I loved that. The second thing I will say is how much I love the Mon Mothma segment, and we first get a glimpse of this in episode 4. I'm one of those weirdos who really loved the political episodes of the Clone Wars, whenever it was just politicians talking about how to push back against Palpatine and talking about war and about money and all that good stuff. I always loved that. So getting to see that as well in a live action portrayal and seeing the fine line that Mon Mothma has to toe, I personally am thrilled to see that side of politics, both in terms of the security state apparatus and in terms of the higher level political machinations.
Yeah, you know, when you mentioned the ISB and how they deal with people's lives in this really cold way, I remembered another line from that scene where they're talking about how they forcibly relocated people in order to access the natural resources, and the person who was delivering the report referenced quote-unquote storage issues with the displaced, you know, which, I mean, talk about real-world parallels. This is chilling stuff when you think about these people sitting around deciding life and death for people for something as, you know, as cold and calculating as we just want the minerals that are under their feet. So they do a great job of showing that side of the empire. You know, as long as we're talking here about overall tone and how grounded the story is, I do think it's worth just putting a finer point on the fact that, you know, you mentioned earlier, there are no Jedi here. There are no lightsabers here. But it's even more than that. You know, we don't see a single stormtrooper. We don't see a single Imperial emblem in the first 3 episodes until we see the Starpath unit that Cassian steals. It's the only thing with the Imperial logo on it. We don't even see, I mean, we see 2 TIE fighters for half a second in the 4th episode, but that is really it in terms of these bigger forces that are, you know, the classic Star Wars heroes are dealing with these things all the time, shooting them out of the sky like it's nothing. But for the heroes of this show, the struggle is much more real. It's much more grounded. It's not that flashy stuff that Luke Skywalker is dealing with. These are really the struggles of ordinary people. And we'll talk a little bit more about Premor and how, you know, showing corporate control as opposed to direct Imperial control gets at this idea of most people probably in the Outer Rim are dealing with corporate governments because the Empire is letting them rule for now. And we start to see where that goes. But it's like this is a whole different side of oppression that Star Wars, at least in live action, hasn't dealt with yet. And I love that element of bringing in the corporate angle, the relationship with the Empire, the relationship with the oppressed people. It's brilliant. It's brilliantly done. And even, you know, even going to little touches throughout these episodes to show that really we're talking about regular people here. Everybody on Twitter loves the Anvil Gong guy.
I love him.
I mean,
I would die for him.
Well, that's a little bit strong, Grace, but you know, he's great. We have to stand, obviously. He takes such pride in his job, and I think moments like having him there to set the scene at the end of the day, showing other people throughout Ferrix, you know, ending their day, you know, the workers hanging their gloves back on that sort of rack of gloves as they finish up their shift at the salvage yard. Even something like, you know, as Luthen is arriving on Ferrix, he's sitting next to the guy with his Bluetooth headset in who won't stop talking to him about how much of a ripoff it is that they have to pay for this transport. And, you know, if you travel, you recognize people like that who are just overly talkative. They don't really get that you're trying to mind your own business. It's these little touches of, oh, I recognize that. That happens in the real world. There was a great voiceover in the 4th episode in the Coruscant Starport terminal, where there's a voiceover that says, do not join the line without your boarding pass, which I just thought was so funny because it's in the background. It's not the point of the scene, but it's like, oh yeah, that they would be saying that if you were in that place, because I certainly hear them say that when I'm in that place in the real world. So I think they've just, you know, Tony Gilroy and the team have figured out a way to infuse that reality, not just into what they write for the characters, but into what they put in the background and how they do characterization, not just dialogue. So I would say on all those fronts, they figured out how to do something that we haven't really seen in Star Wars yet. But, you know, hopefully that will continue for the next few episodes, for the rest of the season.
Yeah, the one more little scene I would add to that list of moments that a lesser show would not necessarily take the time to show Anvil Gong Man or the gloves or the little vignette of every single person that we've seen, both main character and extremely minimal character, seeing their little end of day routine. You know, a lesser show would have skipped over those things, but they're so important for building the characters, building the world. And the episode, or the scene that really got me in the fourth episode, was when we see Luthen transitioning to his Coruscant persona, and he puts on the wig and the clothes and the jewelry. But the really excellent moment is where you see him sort of practicing embodying the physicality of that kind of person. The little flicks of the wrist and the jaunty smile. And it's like he's having to physically put himself back into that character. And it's such a little moment in the episode. It's, you know, 30 seconds, but you just learn so much about the character and what he is and what he's doing from that. And I think that without those little character moments for every character, big or small, or little world building moments, it wouldn't feel the same. It wouldn't be as good as it is. And part of what makes it so good is taking the time for those beats that seem unrelated to the story, but are actually so critical to it.
Yeah, and it's not just that it's like realistic, or that it's like it puts a like a realistic spin on an element of Star Wars that usually isn't that grounded. It's also that a lot of these things are, you know, relatable, right? I mean, how many times have we like practiced reaching out for a handshake, right? Or doing the little things, especially, you know, as journalists, as people who have a public presence who need to be good on TV or whatever, you know, you practice certain ways of interacting, of presenting yourself, because you want to get it right. And I mean, yeah, I've definitely gotten into the suit, you know, to go to an event and like practice those little things just to like make sure that I'm doing it in a way that is presentable. And so watching this whole show, there's a lot of times where you're going, oh, wow, like that's funny that they even thought to do that. And this is the first Star Wars product that I can think of where I was consciously like, oh, wow, good on them for like taking a moment to dwell on this aspect of living. Because as strange as that sounds, Star Wars usually doesn't do that. So we've talked a little bit about Luthen. Let's start to talk here about some of the characters at the top of the call sheet here. And let's start with Cassian, because I think as much as everybody knew, this is Cassian's show. This is the story of his journey to Rogue One. I've been really impressed with how they paid off on all their promises to show him in a different light, to show him as somebody who isn't even the Cassian at the beginning of Rogue One, who even then has clearly a checkered past. This is 5 years earlier, and it's a completely different Cassian, isn't it?
I think that Diego Luna, the actor who plays Cassian, is doing a really good job of showing the glimmers of that future Cassian, the 5 years from now Cassian, but pulling back so that this isn't a Cassian we know, but we see how one day he will become the Cassian we know. And I think that is very well done on his part. And he is even more rough around the edges in this show than he is in Rogue One. If I recall correctly, in Rogue One, he does shoot someone in the back. So it's not like he's never, like we've never seen that from him. But it does establish him as more of an anti-hero, having that very first scene be him getting into a fight with and then ultimately killing these two Primor soldiers. And you know, you can make the argument that they had it coming. But I think that it's very clear this is a different kind of protagonist that we have seen in earlier Star Wars properties, and that there isn't going to be the clear-cut good and bad. This is going to be a character with shades of gray.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you mentioned, the first thing he does in Rogue One is he kills the informant because he doesn't want the Empire to get his hands on him. And then the first thing he does, you know, of substance in this show is he kills the first guy is an accident, but the second guy is begging for his life. And that is just not something that we see in Star Wars, certainly not from people who we are supposed to think of as current or future heroes, right? I mean, this is the kind of stuff that you do to establish that someone's a bad guy. I just thought it was well done that they don't make you the pre-war officers are not like good guys. You're not supposed to hate Cassian, but at the same time, they're presented in a way where there is some element of sympathy there, especially after the first guy goes down and the second guy realizes what's going on. You're not totally on Cassian's side as you watch what happens next, because yeah, they had it coming, but like, it's his choice at that point how to resolve the situation. He chooses the worst possible way. And so right off the bat, you're thinking, oh, wow, what is this guy's deal? Like that he would be willing to take this step. And it's not just the violence either. I mean, that's a key part of it. But it's also, you look at his life on Ferrix, and he owes everybody money. Nobody really likes him except for Bix. Tim certainly does not like him. He makes a point of saying, like, Bix is like, let's go into business together with this salvage, you know, con operation. And he's like, I don't want a partner. I'm working on my own. And you can start to see from the flashbacks how a person might grow up that way, where they're going to do everything it takes to survive. And part of that is not trusting other people, which then makes you wonder, how do we get to Rogue One, where he's willing to not just work for the rebellion, but also trust a lot of these people with his life? This is a Cassian who doesn't want anything to do with any of that. He says to Luthen that he sees all these resistance movements as the same. They're all useless. We get our first mention of the Partisan Front led by Saw Gerrera. And it's basically Cassian's way of saying, I don't want to deal with those problems. I've got big enough problems here. And all those guys are basically just troublemakers, right? He's not distinguishing between any of them. And as Luthen points out, he survived the Battle of Mimban because he ran. And he's just going to keep running because that's all he knows how to do. So you put all that together, and this is just not our typical Star Wars hero.
Yeah, he's very clearly a character whose priority, first and foremost, is survival. And then after survival, the secondary priority of getting money, getting the resources that you need to survive. But because of his upbringing, whatever that may be, we only have seen a few moments of it in the flashbacks. He emphasizes survival over all else. And that doesn't mean that he doesn't form attachments. It's clear that he wants to keep people at arm's length, but it's also clear in his affection for Marva, his sort of maternal figure who took Cassian away from Kanari with the droid who, what is it called,
B2.
With the droid, with Bix, he clearly does have feelings. He's not an automaton,
right?
But he prioritizes his own survival even as he cares for others. He's going to do what he needs to do to make sure that he lives and, you know, that the people he cares about will be okay, but also that he will be okay. So I do think that this is a character who is focused on survival, and because of that, those moral shadings are different from a traditional Star Wars hero.
So the first steps that he starts to take here into the rebellion come courtesy of Luthen Rael, and we talked a little bit about him earlier in terms of inhabiting those mannerisms of the Coruscant elite. And, you know, he's at this point, he's a pretty mysterious guy. We don't know a lot about him, but that moment on his ship was one of the things that really endeared him to me, because we don't really see a lot of rebels who are, you know, comfortable on the front lines of a fight, but then have to go mingle with the rich people in order to get what they want, have to sort of exist in those two worlds. I mean, Leia, I think it's, you know, she was very much in that luxury, you know, rich person world before she was in the combat world, although it's not like there was a huge delay between the two, but she was raised in the rich world. This is the first person who we see who, it doesn't seem like that's the natural place for him, but he does have to go there and he does have to be there because he needs things from those people. So I think already we're starting to see a new type of rebel leader or mid-level figure. And I think that's pretty cool.
Something that I really enjoy about this show is seeing the seeds of the rebellion germinate. And we know that by the time you get to the Battle of Yavin, the rebellion has coalesced. But one of the fun things about this show, one of the fun things about Star Wars Rebels, is seeing those unconnected pockets initially, seeing how they develop naturally and then become interconnected as time goes on. So it's kind of like seeing independent pockets of resistance, which then grow on their own and then connect to each other. So I'm really enjoying that and seeing Luthen as kind of a nexus of one of those pockets. He very clearly is a leader. He is critical in some manner. We don't really know what yet, but in undermining the Empire through his work. And I think it's interesting to see this sort of proto-rebel leader, someone who isn't quite, you know, a card-carrying member of the anti-Empire rebellion, but someone who very clearly is working against the Empire for a cause that eventually will become something more.
Well, and speaking of the early rebellion, let's talk about Mon Mothma. When we were doing our Andor preview episode, I said that, you know, as much as I'm excited for a lot of parts of this show, I'm really here for Mon Mothma. I mean, the promise of Andor for me was getting to see more of her and what she's going through. And to me, the show has just really delivered. Again, you want to talk about firing on all cylinders. There's so much great stuff from her in even just the two sort of main scenes that we see with her. So let's talk about them separately. There's the scene in Luthen's art gallery, and there's the scene at her home. I thought that the scene at the art gallery, Grace, was some of the best Star Wars so far because of all the different layers of what's happening and the way that she and Luthen put on their masks when they're in public, and, you know, that mask that Luthen has practiced on his ship. And then as soon as they're in private, their voices lower, they get down to business, there's no more smiles. And you can tell, especially from Mon, how natural all of this is to her. She slips easily in and out of these two things. And so there's an element of competence and mastery of the double speak. But at the same time, we're seeing another side of her, the one that they said that we were going to see, that was sort of the promise of the show, is getting inside her head a little bit, going behind the mask. And she's scared. She's worried. I mean, she can see the net tightening around her. And you look at certainly Return of the Jedi, but also Rogue One and Clone Wars, and we don't see this side of her because at this point, she doesn't have that support network around her, or at least she can't lean on it as much as openly as she will be able to later. And so she's moving through all these spaces, but she can tell that everybody's watching her and that everybody knows that something's going on with her, and they're just waiting. They are waiting until they can take her, you know, take her down, call her in on some charge of sedition or whatever. She mentions there's like a new spy in the Senate every week, which I thought is a great line because on the one hand, it shows she's getting pretty good at figuring out who the spy is. So she's wise to their tricks. But on the other hand, it still makes things more difficult for her. It still adds that layer of somebody is looking over your shoulder. Luthen's assistant says like, oh, she has a new driver. And at first I was like, huh, interesting line. And then she points out, yeah, you know, Luthen says like, you have a new driver. And she's like, oh yeah, like clearly this is also an Imperial spy, or at least she thinks that's possible. I love when she said, you know, I go to the bank and all the people I see there are new. And it's like, imagine the level of time and effort that goes into it on the Empire's part of, like, deploying an entirely new staff for a bank just to try to catch her doing something illicit or suspect. I just thought that's such a great indicator of, like, she is public enemy number one at this point, but we're still in that weird moment where they can't just quite act on it. The Senate still exists. She hasn't declared the rebellion yet. And so it's this uneasy moment of, we can't arrest her yet, but we are certainly looking for an excuse to do so.
You know, say what you will about every Star Wars show being based on existing characters and people getting tired of not wanting new or not getting new things. But I think that for a story based on a character who gets like 30 seconds in A New Hope, this is pretty great. This is adding a whole level of texture and intricacy to a character, a level of vulnerability that I never would have expected that we would get for this character, who throughout Star Wars has kind of been portrayed as a very sanguine, peaceful, sort of resistance fighter, but fighting in a very diplomatic way. She has always seemed very calm, very serene. And to see the vulnerability behind that, I think is really cool. I also think it's interesting to see her home life, see her not great relationship with her husband, who clearly is more interested in the trappings of power than in what the Empire actually represents and is actually doing. And it's clear that their relationship is very fractured and not built on a steady foundation. And you want to know more about that and see how they got to that point and how this will play into Mon's future career decisions. So I really loved both of these scenes, seeing her at work and at home, and in a sense, it seems like both of those are work. It seems like there's no real place that she feels safe. She's not safe in the Senate or even in her car, and she's not safe at home where she has a husband who, intentionally or not, will be working against her and her interests. So I think seeing every layer is very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, think about like going to work in that environment and having to be on guard all the time. You really want to be able to go home and take the mask off and take comfort in your loved ones, whether that's your kids or your best friend or your spouse. Like, that is the place where you should be able to go and feel safe and decompress. And she can't do that. There's an extra cruelty in that, or an extra burden in that element of her life being so fractured, as you said, where she can't go to him for solace and comfort, because in a sense, he's part of the problem, right? In a sense, he's a big part of the problem. He's not out there commanding troops to commit atrocities, but he's the kind of person who helps sustain the political support for the atrocities or for looking the other way in a power center like Coruscant. And you wonder, you know, we've established at this point, Tony Gilroy has talked about how they got married when she was 16, which is apparently a normal thing on Chandrilla, and she has a child. And so they've been together for a long time, and it was an arranged marriage. And so you really wonder what that's like for her to have a life that I think I wouldn't have predicted for a person from Chandrilla, which I think is sort of made out to be, you know, sort of an idyllic planet, much like Alderaan, where everybody's pretty much happy and there aren't like things like arranged child marriages, which is not a typical feature of a healthy modern society. But that's what happens there. And it sort of makes you rethink where she's coming from and what her life must have been like. And I just love that scene when she's at home and they're having this verbal, you know, sparring session where he's basically saying, like, you are such a killjoy. Like, I just want to have my fancy dinner party with all my fancy Imperial friends. And you're out here talking about blockading star systems to cut off their food sources. And it's like, can I have one night to have fun without dealing with all your politics? You know, it's like I sort of thought of, it's like, he sees her as like a social justice warrior, and he's like tired of it, really. And I just think it's obviously tragic for her, but as a viewer, it's like, this is just a nice, interesting way to make her a more nuanced three-dimensional character, as opposed to the sort of happy paragon of democracy who is fighting an uphill battle, but is sort of at least like living a good sort of personal life. And it's like, no, she doesn't even have that at this point. And they have this real argument, like a very realistic husband-wife argument. And she kind of wraps it up by saying, listen, if you make me pay attention at this dinner party, I'm going to make you regret it, because I'm going to talk about why all these people are jerks, and it's going to be embarrassing for you, and you do not want me to do that. I just think that's such a great relationship to show on screen here, and I really hope that in the next episode, we see her causing a ruckus.
Yeah, I am really looking forward to seeing where this show goes next for Mon Mothma, for honestly all of the characters. As you were talking, I was thinking about what a good job that the actor for Mon Mothma is doing, Genevieve O'Reilly. And then I was thinking about, well, Diego Luna is doing a really good job, and Stellan Skarsgård's doing a really good job. And it's just, I'm just enjoying so much the layers that every actor is bringing to their character. And the other thing about episode 4 is you get to see even greater elements of this world, or galaxy rather, that we are just beginning to understand. So seeing the ISB, the corporate surveillance state, seeing where Karn, the now fired Primor security guy, lives, where his mom lives, seeing the planet where Cassian is about to go on this really fun sort of heisty endeavor that hopefully we will see more of next episode. It's like every episode expands the world. And if the first three episodes were this very tight introduction that really was like a movie, then the fourth episode brings us into this larger galaxy.
Yeah, and let's just talk briefly about some of those organizations that you mentioned. I think it's just so great to see the ISB take center stage like this. This is an organization that's been part of Star Wars in the expanded universe for decades, and we've started to see examples of it in canon, but here they are at the center of the story, and it's this great example of basically office politics, but with these Star Wars trappings and these high stakes. And I just love it. I love, you know, Major Partagaz, who is played by the guy who played Qyburn in Game of Thrones, who is the perfect, like, boss on this show for the ISB slice of the story, who is just, like, trying to manage all these different officers who are working for him. I just love the scenes with him and Dedra Miro and the male ISB officer, as they're all kind of jockeying for power, and she's trying to say, hey, I have jurisdiction here, and the other guy's like, just, you know what, stick to your sectors, I'll stick to my sectors. And I can't wait to see where this goes, because they've made us actually care about an ISB officer and want to see how she claws her way up the ladder. And again, you know, going back to talking about you know, other characters that we've already seen, it's just great that they're making us care about these people, and it's great that they are making it relatable and realistic in a way where we can grab onto it and recognize things that we see in the world around us. But again, it's got the Star Wars costume layered on top of it. I don't know, what did you think about, you know, what we see here of the way that the ISB operates as an organization? I think it's just so beautifully crafted.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. I have already waxed poetic about my love of politics and seeing that portrayed here for the first time. And again, it reminds me of some of the Star Wars books, in particular the Thrawn books, but also even in New Dawn, which is the Rebels prequel books, takes you into some of the imperial backstabbing. And I think it's really fun to see that and sort of experience Star Wars in a new way and from a new perspective. And that I always thought was one of the great achievements of the Thrawn books, was making me care about this guy who works for the Empire and is trying to rise through the ranks in the Empire, which is objectively bad. And seeing how this show is making me care about characters in the Empire, not sympathizing, or rather not empathizing with them, not thinking that their cause is great, but understanding the way that they operate and wanting to see them further develop, I think that's very interesting and new for Star Wars.
Yeah, and the whole ISB storyline in the fourth episode, when it meshes with Primor and what's happening on Ferrix, it does give us this great window into, well, why would the Empire start to take more direct control over what's going on the fringes? And it's because they outsourced it to these corporate buffoons, basically, who are messing it up across the galaxy. That male ISB officer has a moment where he tells the Primor folks, like, I've got files full of examples of you corporate folks messing up. And so it's like, okay, here's an example of why the Empire's tightening its grip. It's because it has realized that outsourcing doesn't work anymore. And so we get to see the Primor people as both the villains for our heroes, but then also as sort of subservient to the ultimate big bad, which is the Empire. And when the Empire shows up, you better fall in line, no matter how, you know, wicked you are to the people below you. You answer to somebody else. And I just love that we got that explored on the show, not just mentioned in a one-off line, but this is actually an important B-plot of this episode, is the bureaucracy and how different levels, the government, the corporate elements of the bureaucracy interact. I mean, who thought we'd be talking about this on a Star Wars show? But not only that, who thought we'd be talking about it working well? And I think it works really well.
I absolutely love the idea that corporations are the sort of governing bodies of these planets in the Outer Rim, and that the Empire is sort of tacitly allowing them to continue sort of working in tandem with them as long as the corporations do their job. And when they don't, the Empire steps in. And the corporation is still the security apparatus. It is the puppet of the Empire once the Empire fully steps in. But it's just really fun to see that sort of creep, to see how a corporation may initially agree to ally itself with the Empire, and then how the Empire would slowly subsume that corporation for its own purposes. And I think it's a really interesting commentary on how authoritarianism can be aided and abetted by commercial interests, but then ultimately those interests are subsumed. And so I think that's a really fun way of showing, you know, how does the Empire get control of an entire frickin' galaxy? And it is through practices like this. It's through going through the existing structures of power. It's through occupation in terms of relocating people and harnessing resources. It's really just kind of a lesson in how to be a really good colonizer and occupier on a massive scale. And I think that is very interesting, but also very explicit. This show has a message, and it's not afraid to show it.
Yeah, and you know, it doesn't work if you don't have a realistic and interesting sort of corporate bureaucracy to be kind of that middleman. And I think they nailed it with the Primor folks. I mean, the only thing I'll say specifically is just Karn is such a great character. All of the Primor people are so fully fleshed out and three-dimensional. And again, they have like countless analogs in the real world where you're like, oh, I know a person like that, or I've heard of a person, I've seen people like that. Karn specifically, though, is so great, and being that prideful person who's like, I'm gonna lead this mission and stamp out and get justice for my company, basically, and then to get tossed aside for making too much trouble and messing it up, and now moving in with his mom. I mean, the idea of like having even a C plot in a Star Wars show of a villain moving in with his mom, like a disgraced villain moving in with his mom, how great is that? I hope we get a whole episode where it's like, he has to do the dishes, he has to walk the space dog. Like, I don't know, Grace, what do you want to see from Karn living with Mama Karn?
I am so looking forward to him going totally crazy. I think
because he's living in his childhood bedroom, right? So that's going to be awkward as well.
Yes. I mean, I think it's going to be freaking awesome when he just goes insane. And every sort of decision that he's made has led to this moment. And I think I can't wait to see what he does. I think he's going to be a true wild card in the rest of the show. And, you know, the various ways in which he's going to continue to crack and thus wreak havoc on the plot. Because I think even if he is incorporated into the ISB, which I believe has been hinted at in trailers, he's a wild card. He is not someone who is going to toe the line. I think that he's going to be caught up in revenge, and I can't wait to see how having to do the laundry in his mom's house is going to fully push him over the eye twitchy edge.
Do you think, Grace, that it could lead to carnage?
Yeah, maybe.
Carnage. Do you get it, Grace? Carnage.
I did. I was deliberately denying you the pleasure.
Because it's normally spelled with a C, but his name is spelled with a K. You know what? It's fine. We'll talk about it later. I do just want to touch on a few things, kind of production-related things that I think we can't end the episode without talking about some of the choices that they made stylistically that make this just such a great show. I mean, right from the start, showing us that this takes place 5 years before the Battle of Yavin and putting that on screen, BBY, which if you're a hardcore Star Wars fan, there's just something cool about seeing that on screen elevated to that level. And it also doubles as a reminder that Cassian has 5 years left to live. So it plays a story role, but it also is validation to fans of in terms of the chronologically obsessive people that, hey, like, we think it's notable that you understand when this is taking place, and we're used to that with the books and whatever, but this is the first time we've seen it this way. I thought that was great. I've made no secret of the fact that I love Coruscant. Grace, I think you do too. It is a fantastic planet that has not gotten nearly enough screen time, especially in the Disney era. I am so thrilled that it is back center stage, and there's something genuinely emotional about seeing the establishing shot of the planet from space and seeing the word Coruscant come up, which is great enough on its own, but then the subtitle under it, Capital of the Galaxy. There's just something, I don't know, it just indescribably cool about that, of giving it that validation of, we're now taking you to the center of the action. This is where everything happens. And not just doing it, but also kind of nodding at it explicitly and saying like, yes, we understand that this is the cool planet and we're going to show it to you now. I thought that was great. Overall, I would say the production design on this show has been top notch. So credit to Luke Hull, who is probably best known for the production design on Chernobyl, which is another beautiful show. They really have distinctive environments on Andor, from the red light district on Morlana 1 to the design of Ferrix. I mean, we mentioned earlier that wall of gloves, all the colorful gloves. ISB headquarters is this great mix of, yes, it's Star Wars, but it's also just this kind of Orwellian, you know, corporate sort of surveillance state, austere building, perfectly designed. And the other thing I will shout out is the first time we see Ferrix. It's B2, the droid, trundling along on the ground, and those like dogs come out and pee on him, which is this kind of irreverent, funny moment. But the shot begins and then continues with him just sort of humming along, and there's this great like bouncy music that plays as you see Ferrix for the first time. And I thought that was just such a great shot. I don't really know. I don't have anything deep to say about it, but it was just so well composed that you can tell that they put a lot of thought into the character of each of these planets. And that effort and that hard work, it pays off. I mean, it really shows. You get something special out of each of these environments. So I did just want to make those comments about the production design. Grace, I don't know if there's anything you wanted to throw in there.
I did love the BBY. I was very glad that I was watching it with my fiance, who did not understand what BBY was, and then I explained what BBY is before Battle of Yavin, and then had to explain what the Battle of Yavin was. But I hope that every relatively casual Star Wars fan who sees 5BBY and had no idea what that means had someone with them who is a total nerd and could explain for them. But either way, it's a great establishing little shot of where we are. I obviously agree the production design is great. I think even the smallest visuals are really cool. So there's a section or a scene where Tim is looking at an alert for a Canary man, and the text comes to life, I guess, visualizes next to his head.
Yeah.
And it was just really cool. I don't even know how to describe it. I'm not good enough with TV and movie production to describe what I'm saying, so hopefully the people who have watched this show know what I'm saying, so I don't sound totally incoherent. But just even the little details are really neat, and the way that's presented, I love. And I guess the final thing that I would emphasize again is how I really like that this show is not shying away from topics that are controversial, not just for Star Wars, but in the real world. So it clearly very much is an immigrant story, a refugee story, a story about the experiences that immigrants and refugees have in unfriendly territories, the way that they can be singled out for their accents and appearances. And it's clearly a story about the security state, about the surveillance state, about the corporate state. And, you know, it's not hammering you over the head with any of its messages, but they're very clearly there. And I just really appreciate that thus far they have actually committed to that, and I hope that they continue to do so.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it's a great mix of like having those Star Wars references and dwelling on like the Star Wars moments for fans, you know, whether it's BBY or like kind of giving us that lingering moment of Coruscant. But then also we're trying to tell a story of realistic struggle. And so we're going to have the Star Wars layering on top. But at the bottom, it's a story about, as you said, these common themes that we can all understand, and they have characters who have these common traits where you can go, oh, I know somebody like that. And that's what you need in a TV show, whether it's Star Wars or anything else. You can have all the Easter eggs you want, but it's got to have that familiarity at its root, or you're not going to be able to grab onto it. So I think Tony Gilroy and his team deserve immense credit for getting that right so far. You know, I did mention Easter eggs. I just want to mention a few before we go. If you are a longtime Star Wars fan, and particularly a fan of Coruscant and the Empire, you probably jumped out of your seat when Mon Mothma was reading the dinner guest list and she mentioned Arz Dangor and Sly Moore. This is, to me, an example of what I was talking about in our Andor episode, where you want to have Easter eggs that make sense and that fit in and that aren't just, you know, Luke showing up to train Grogu, but like, okay, this actually would you probably have people like this on that guest list, right? And so it's a nice moment for diehard fans like me to go, oh my God, they said the thing. But it's also like, yeah, no, who else would you have there? Like, of course you're going to have those people. So I like that. I like that a lot. I think it's a great example of how to do the Easter eggs well. Mon also mentions, you know, Imperial reprisal against the planet Gorman, which, if you remember Star Wars Rebels, the Gorman massacre, which is initially established in the EU, that's what prompts her to declare the rebellion, basically. So we're kind of walking into that very clearly. I thought it was nice to nod at that. And then there's just all kinds of little things. If you go to my Twitter, I tweeted out a bunch of them, but references to things from the EU. There's the Ferrix shipyard has a bunch of ships in it that if you pause it, you can see, you know, the ghost, not the ghost, but the same ship as the ghost is in that shipyard. There's references in the Coruscant spaceport voiceover dialogue to planets from role-playing game source books. I mean, Luthen's gallery has everything from a Twi'lek religious artifact to Mandalorian armor. There's stone fragments from the World Between World from Rebels. I mean, there's all these things. We'll put a link in our show notes to a couple Twitter threads that have screenshots of these things. It's stuff that, again, makes sense where and when it is. And if you're a fan, you'll recognize it. You'll go, oh my God, the Rakatan invaders. I know those guys from Knights of the Old Republic. But if you don't know anything about that, it's three words of dialogue in a sentence, and it washes over you, and you're moving on, and it doesn't interrupt the narrative. And I think this is how to do it. This is how to do Easter eggs. I wanted to make that point because it's not easy to do. It's easy to do wrong. I think they got it right.
Yeah, I would totally agree with all of that, and just also echo your enjoyment of all of the little Easter eggs in Luthen's gallery, the Calicori, the holocrons, presumably inactive, the World Between Worlds references. I mean, all great. And I totally agree that this is how Easter eggs should be done. How they can be done. They can be really subtle. They don't need to throw it in your face and be a wink wink, because those who want to get it will get it. And those who don't will be totally fine without that basis of knowledge. So, yeah, totally agree.
And it's a testament to how much is packed into these four episodes that there is so much other stuff, Grace, in our show notes that we didn't even get to. I mean, we didn't even talk about Kanari and the flashbacks. We didn't talk about the adorable little stair droid that pulls up to the shuttle and basically positions itself to be a staircase. Shout out to the stair droid. I mean, you know, hopefully we'll be able to touch on some more of these themes in the next few episodes, but there's just so much packed in here. I can't wait to see where they go next with the show.
Yeah, totally agree. I can't wait for our next episode debriefing it all. And hopefully we'll be able to touch on many more things, including those flashbacks and stair droid, but also whatever is yet to come.
All right, thanks for listening to our episode on the first four episodes of Andor. If you want to share your thoughts about this episode of Hoth Takes or suggest topics that we can cover in future shows, please email us at hothtakes@gmail.com, or you can find us on Twitter at Hoth Takes. I'm Eric Geller on Twitter. Grace is Grace_Seegers, and Haley is Burdenator. Haley made our wonderful logo and banner art. I edited this show and put together our music, although again, for legal purposes, we do want to note all Star Wars themes and sound effects are the intellectual property of Lucasfilm. You can find a complete archive of Hoth Takes episodes on our website, hothtakes.wordpress.com. And if you like the podcast, please share it with a friend or a family member. You can find Hoth Takes on all the major podcasting platforms. That includes, of course, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. We will see you next time. May the Force be with you.